Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Takeout ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
But who's counting, right?
His name is Major.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
Please welcome Major Garrett.
From the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's The Takeout.
This is a major achievement.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major Garrett.
Yes, CBS. Yes, hi.
Major Garrett.
Major, that's nonsense, and you should know better.
Is Major out of the doghouse?
The answer is yes.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. You know, we celebrate books here at The Takeout. We especially celebrate books by CBS correspondents. So, This is a celebratory week, ladies and gentlemen, because out this week, a new book by my colleague Jonathan Vigliotti, the title, Before It's Gone, subtitle, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Jonathan, great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Major.
Tell my audience about the emphasis on small town America and climate change.
Small towns to me are, to use a popular phrase, a canary in a coal mine for what all of our communities across the country face when it comes to climate change and the impact that climate change is having on radicalizing our weather. Small towns don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the money that you find in larger cities. And therefore, when a disaster hits these communities, it hits hard. And recovering from these disasters is also hard and slow and oftentimes delayed. And because these are smaller communities, oftentimes the media arrives, spends a few days, maybe a week or two, and then leaves and rarely revisits. And so you have communities that are picking up the pieces when it comes to extreme weather. We're talking years, decades after a storm hits. And they don't have the spotlight and they don't have the attention that they deserve, but not just survivors. They certainly deserve all of the attention, but these survivors have lessons to teach us all of what they have been through, of what they have witnessed, their experiences, what they took for granted before, in this case, a storm hit and turned their world upside down. And I feel like in telling those stories, we can teach others, at least as a journalist and from my perspective as one, teach others what people on the flip side of luck, those who have been unlucky, unfortunate, who have lost in so many cases everything, what they can learn from those experiences to make their own lives, their own communities more resilient. And so I focus on these small towns because that's where a lot of these storms have taken me. And I've met incredible people on these front lines whose stories have really stuck with me. And a lot of this was just out of my desire to keep in touch with them and to keep following up with them, to see how they're doing, but also to then channel that information I was getting, my own education on our front lines of climate change in a way that could be meaningful for others that are fortunate to have a home to call home, that have a 30-year mortgage, that don't at any point think they're not going to be able to live in their homes for those 30 years, like so many survivors once thought until life was flipped upside down.
Jonathan, I know you have done this work for a very long time, but refresh my audience's memory about how long you've been doing this and name check some of these small towns that most resonate in this book and in your mind.
Of course. So as a CBS correspondent, I've been with CBS since 2015. I first started off as a foreign correspondent in London. And my first hurricane was Hurricane Irma. I was actually brought in while overseas to help assist. I eventually moved to Los Angeles for the West Coast Bureau in 2019. And that's when I primarily began and found myself in this role of pinballing across the country, focused on the environmental impact that a lot of communities are facing as climate change has radicalized weather events. My first true experience with a major disaster was the Camp Fire, which destroyed Paradise. I was still in London at the time of the Camp Fire, but when I came here to LA about 6 months later, I was sent to that community to do a piece, to revisit, to see how they were doing. And to see the destruction up close like that for the first time after watching it all unfold on television for several weeks, and to see just how much had been destroyed and what that community was faced with in terms of its recovery and its rebuilding, it struck a chord with me. And that began a line of other stories of other disasters by different names, where initially I wasn't connecting the dots for my audience. I wasn't linking climate change to the event that I was covering. It was almost as if I was covering these events as they were singular individual crises, not connected. But the more that I started to really focus in on the climate science, speaking with scientists for other stories, the more it became very clear to me that all of this is connected. And so I was driven to continue to make those connections because I have incredible access as a journalist. We all do for CBS. We are launched to these places. We're allowed to see the way that our world works. And I like to think that storytelling is obviously a critical component of all of this. So that was a big push for me, making sure I tell the stories that are vital. I connect the science so people understand. Paradise was obviously one storm that really resonated with me. I think what unfolded in Lahaina just last year was probably the most traumatic storm I've ever covered in both what happened to the community and perhaps what could have been prevented. Because before this storm hit, as I've learned with most disasters, there were scientists who had been ignored. And we can explore that in this podcast, but I wanted to draw attention to that in that reporting. And it was the first time I saw really in action what happens when that critical message that scientists have been delivering to us for nearly two centuries, what happens when those warnings go ignored, go unheeded, and they become self-fulfilling prophecies.
And in Lahaina, you also talk about mismanagement and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Explain.
Yeah, so let me take you back when we first arrived. So I got the call very early in the morning on August 9th, so 12 hours after this fire ripped through Lahaina. And we were one of the first network crews to arrive in Lahaina, and it's not like we were able to just drive up in our car. We were actually confronted by a roadblock with police telling us it was too dangerous to go inside. But at this roadblock, we were with survivors, residents who had escaped, and they were trying to get back in because they desperately wanted to see if their homes had survived. And they told us that we weren't being allowed in along with them because the government didn't want us to see what they were describing to us as a failed emergency response. So that's when our team, bypassing those roadblocks, we chartered a boat. And an hour and a half later, we're dropped off along a cindered shoreline. In my book, I describe it as an environmental holocaust. And I spoke to you. I went live with you during all of this at that point. I mean, we saw home after home, business after business decimated. Entire neighborhoods have been destroyed. In those first 20 minutes, we saw a handful of survivors, people who had were in their homes when this fire happened and were now surveying the damage of their neighborhoods in a state of shock. Some look like ghosts with ash on their face. We didn't see any first responders. In those first few days, we went back and forth to Lahaina for 3 days before FEMA arrived and taped off the entire area. And time again, we kept being told that there were no evacuation orders. We heard of people that were waiting in hotels for days without any kind of food, without power, without water. And we would later hear from leaders who described this fire as an explosion. It was like a bomb going off. Literally what they said time and time again at these press conferences, it was as if to imply that there was no warning and therefore no time to take action. But as we learned in those days and weeks to follow, and as we reported, there was a years-long fuse, a nearly decade-long fuse that could have been put out at any point, because in 2014, scientists on the island came out with a report that showed the warming atmosphere was warming up the island and it was making the place vulnerable to wildfire. They even had suggestions for what to do to mitigate and to protect the island from destruction, including restoring wetlands, which had been decimated because of the growing population, conserving water, removing dry invasive grasses that had taken root. They even suggested building with more fire-resistant materials that applied for tax credits and would have reduced insurance rates for homeowners. And yet, this report was essentially filed away and no action was taken. And so what would have happened is a question that I asked myself then. And as we reported very briefly, we have a sense, because in the miles-long path of destruction that we uniquely were able to walk before it was closed off, this is the disaster zone of Lahaina, we walked up and down Front Street, 4 miles.
Jonathan, let me jump in and stop you right there. That's a good place to stop. I need to hit a hard break, and then we will come back. Our continuing conversation with Jonathan Vigliotti, the book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Segment 2 of The Takeout coming your way in just 1 second.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome back to The Takeout, continuing our conversation with Jonathan Vigliotti. The new book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Jonathan, I had to interrupt you, and I apologize for that, about your observations about Lahaina and the fire.
No, of course. So my team and I, we walked 2 miles in each direction down historic Front Street. And the question where we left off was, what would have happened if those scientific warnings and suggestions had been taken? And in that miles-long path of destruction, there was one home in a neighborhood that was destroyed, still standing, unscathed. It's known today as the house with the red roof. And those homeowners, they had implemented those scientific remedies. They removed dry invasive grasses around their property. They removed bushes. They removed trees. The concern being if a fire ever happened and hit those trees, it could springboard onto the house. They also created a stone moat around the foundation of their home using river stones. And the appeal to that was if a fire ever sparked on grass and made its way up to the foundation, it'd be stopped by that moat. That's exactly what happened during this fire. The flame stopped at that moat. This house also put a new roof, the red roof, in metal. And so when ash and when flame landed around it and on it in some cases, it couldn't burn down the house. So these homeowners, even when local leaders weren't taking specific action or waited until it was too late, they had the power within their own ability to do this, and they did, and they survived. And in every storm, by different names across the country, there are examples of homes with a red roof, people who listened and took action. They were more sensitive to the information, more aware of it than others. And part of the reason I wrote this book, and that house now serves as an inspiration for my future reporting, is more people need to be aware of the science in their neighborhoods and their communities and what can be done so that they have the individual ability and power to take action. They don't need to wait for their entire community to come through. They can do it on their own. Of course, the more people who build homes with the red roof, again, using in some cases federal funding to do so and saving on their own insurance costs. The more resilient neighborhoods, the more resilient communities will be when faced with extreme weather fueled by climate change.
And if governments, Jonathan, are not proactive, they will suffer more as a result of storms, be they hurricane, fire, or something else.
That's correct. And the research is out. Last year, 2.5 million people were forced from their home because of extreme weather. And according to a new study that was released just this month, there's clear data that shows at least half of American homes face some kind of climate threat. Whether or not they've been touched by this yet, that's not the case. But at any point, many communities, depending on where they are, could be faced with an extreme storm that has been fueled by climate change. So more and more people are vulnerable. More and more local communities and leaders in those communities need to heed the warnings of scientists and take those mitigation efforts that are oftentimes recommended in these reports to make their communities more resilient. It's entirely in the power of local communities to enforce this change.
Two of the most livable states in our country, Florida and California, mm-hmm. are experiencing a home insurance crisis. In California, it is very difficult to obtain any kind of insurance for your home. Yes. The state of California has had to backstop with state funds the private insurance market. It's not that dire in Florida, but it's close to that, and rates mm-hmm. have skyrocketed in Florida. Both of these are consequences of climate change and radicalized weather, are they not?
They are. And in fact, I bought my home where I am in Hollywood, a low fire risk here, right near the Hollywood Bowl. For anybody that knows this area, there's a lot of concrete around. And I say all of this because when I was looking for insurance for my home, it was difficult to find affordable rates. I went to a number of insurance companies online and was quoted at $1,000 to $1,500 a month. I thought for sure I wasn't going to be able to afford this home until I found insurance that was much more affordable. And the reality is, you know, the government here has taken steps to protect homeowners, but how long will that last? There is a significant number of properties here in California, 40% of properties that face some kind of wildfire threat. And as the climate continues to warm, that is likely to grow. And as more people looking for affordable housing move into the wildland urban interface, this area of our communities that is very close to nature, kind of further away from these concrete landscapes like major urban centers like LA, more people are going to face those threats and going to find it very difficult to find affordable insurance. But again, so many homes are currently vulnerable, which is why you see states like California taking action to keep insurance companies here and in action and working.
Jonathan, as you know, there's still a enduring, nasty political squabble over climate change. But mm-hmm. reading your book and reading lots of other books on this topic, for people who live close to the source of these radicalized weather events, they don't really debate it anymore.
They don't debate it. Many still don't say climate change in their conversations. I think climate change can be abstract for a lot of people. But those who have lived through any one of these disasters, they look at their communities in a whole new light. We were talking about Paradise. There was one family there specifically that has inspired me throughout the duration of me writing this book. It took me 3 years to write it, and they've been in the back of my head the entire time. Kylie and Ellie Werbel, a mother and daughter team, who escaped Paradise, saved themselves just barely, and from day one looked to return back to Paradise. They knew the threats. They had family and friends that left and thought they were crazy for staying. And in their minds, it was very clear they had no decision, no choice. This was their home. This was where all of their traditions were formed. They were a third generation family living in Paradise. Kylie's parents and grandparents all lived there. And they saw this as an opportunity, not just to hold on to their tradition and to create new ones, but to rebuild this town in a safer way, in a way that worked with their habitat, worked with the fire threat, to reduce the fire threat by reducing dry vegetation, which is exactly what they did around their home. It took them 2.5 years to finally put their home back on the lot that completely burned down And I've been visiting them back and forth over the course of the past 4 years. And it was incredible to first see them in their home that they now call Faith, because they have faith that everything that they have put into their property and into making their community more resilient will ultimately work out for them. As they said, there are no trees left to burn down. But beyond that, power lines have been buried underground now. Other homes have taken all of these mitigation efforts, including fire-resistant materials and removing all of that dry fuel, what is called defensible space. So they have hope that they could build a better future for themselves. That was so inspiring to me. They recognize climate change as a threat, though they don't say it so openly because it is a politicized term. It has become political. Although you talk to anybody, including them, and they will say, once you face fire, once you face a disaster that has been fueled by climate change, there's no going back to any other understanding. We are all at risk, as they have said to me. And the key to reducing that risk is to listening and to taking those actions that they did at their home. Time will tell how resilient this community is. Only a quarter of the population has returned. And the mayor told me he expects only half the population to return in 15 years. So there's a lot of work that these communities face. And I think their message is so important for other communities that are on the front lines of climate change, that are exposed to extreme weather, to listen and to take whatever action they can that's within their power and their local communities.
Jonathan, very quickly, is there any community that's not on the front lines?
There are communities that are not on the front lines. Upstate New York, and this is based on research, in some areas in upstate New York, considered incredibly safe, out of risk from flooding, out of risk from hurricanes and tornadoes and wildfires. But the research also shows more people are actually moving into areas that are not safe. There's a risk mitigation firm called Aon, which tracks real estate. And in the last 40 years, they found that 6 times more people are moving into coastal areas prone to flooding than into nearby inland communities that are deemed much safer. And I would like to think these aren't people that are intentionally choosing to put themselves in harm's way. This is their investment. This is their family. Mm-hmm. This is their lives. So what is it then? It's this abstraction that is climate change. I was listening to a TED Talk, and Major, you may be familiar with Dan Gilbert, the Harvard psychologist.
Jonathan, I have to jump in one more time for a quick break. Hold that thought. That's a nice grabber. Jonathan Vigliotti on the other side of this break. Segment 3 of The Takeout coming your way in just one moment. Welcome back to The Takeout. Jonathan Vigliotti, I had to jump in. Please continue.
Yeah, so Dan Gilbert, a psychologist at Harvard University and a featured TED talker. That's how I first discovered him. He gave a TED talk. I saw it on YouTube probably 6 or 7 years ago. And he was specifically talking during that talk about the key to happiness. And in that talk, he focused on the prefrontal cortex. So follow me for a second. It's a part of our brain, unlike any other animal in the kingdom, that allows us to imagine things before they happen. It's part of this adaptation we have to prevent us from doing foolish things. And it's triggered in part through storytelling, stories that are shared to us by friends, family, the media, strangers. And when we listen and when the information that's provided to us is clear, we can connect the dots between cause and effect. When it's not clear, we turn our brains off. We fail to imagine. And so I was thinking about these anti-smoking campaigns, the ones that you see on television where you have someone in some state of suffering trying to warn others not to pick up a pack of cigarettes. Have you seen those?
Indeed, I have.
As I did more research on this, because I've seen them and I always wondered how effective they were. And I can still visualize ads that I've seen from many years ago. In New York City, the health department found for every dollar it spent on its campaign, it saved $32 in medical costs. So people clearly saw the message. They clearly understood the message. It wasn't an abstract message, and they took action. Climate change can be abstract, and the measures that need to be taken to reduce the threat can be daunting to people. The research is out there that shows that. And I understand why, because you have something like climate change that requires a global community to buy in. We all have to reduce our use of fossil fuels, which emit greenhouse gases, which warm the planet, which radicalize our weather. But even if we stopped that today, we stopped all greenhouse gas emissions, it would take decades to see a positive result in our environment because of what is called a delayed feedback loop, similar to when you take aspirin for a headache. The headache doesn't go away immediately. It takes 30 minutes. Well, to reduce our planet's fever is going to take more time. But in the meantime, and this is the message I try to get across in this book, and I hope it's successful, there's another change that we have more power over, and it's habitat change, how we alter our communities from wetlands like in Lahaina to water conservation to building in safer places. I think the more that we draw these connections to what can be done in our hometowns, the more people will feel like they have the power to take control. So yes, there are communities that are safer than others. For some reason, one reason or another, people are not choosing to live in those communities. Perhaps if they knew the true threats from some areas that they're moving into, they would change their mind. And yet, if they still are forced to move or need to move and want to go to a coastal area, my hope is that they will be empowered to then take action in their own communities to make those areas, those main streets, more resilient to our climate change fueled weather.
And when we talk about habitat, Jonathan, explain the role that beavers play and how a human-like beaver behavior is also trying to improve habitat resilience.
I had never given much thought to the beaver. before this story that I did for CBS Mornings, a scientist found after a wildfire that there was one area that did not burn. It was a few acres of very vibrantly green terrain. And when she went there to explore, she found that there was a beaver dam. That beaver dam acted, unlike concrete dams that us humans build, this beaver dam was just a speed bump, almost like a filter. It slowed water down, allowed it to pool, allowed it to hydrate the area, creating this vibrant wetland and ecosystem that when a wildfire did spark in that area, the flames could not take hold because the plants were so alive, had so much moisture in them. And so based on that information, she went out and really started to spread the word on the benefits of beavers, which then led to another organization developing what are known as beaver analog dams. Essentially, these dams that are built by humans to help reintroduce beavers to other areas. So why this needs to be done? There aren't enough rivers anymore in certain areas that have enough water where the beaver can naturally escape predators. So I went with one of these organizations and we went to Utah and to a place called Colville, where a rancher who at one point didn't want beavers because he didn't like the flooding, now faced with so much drought in the area, wanted beavers back. We went and built a dam in a river, which created a pool. And the hope is that area will become resilient again, that a wetland will be restored, and that in that restoration, that landscape will be more resilient to wildfires. So, you know, the bear gets a lot of attention for fighting wildfires, Smokey the Bear. But when you talk to any one of these researchers or people that are in charge of building these beaver analog dams, they're also petitioning for the beaver to be included next to Smokey because of their impact in making their communities and making their ecosystems resilient.
Jonathan, anyone in this business knows you don't do it by yourself, so I want to give you the opportunity to thank those who work alongside you before we move on.
Yeah, Christian Duran, a fantastic producer who I have worked in the field specifically on that beaver story and while in Lahaina. He shoots a lot of his own stuff, does audio, does it all. He's amazing. Walker Dawson, another great producer that I've worked with, Simon Bowie, spent a lot of time with me in Paradise. Roger Masterton, a photographer who is often on the front lines with myself. Gilbert Diaz, another photographer. Dave Lowther, who does audio. I mean, the list goes on. I'm leaving so many people out, but these are people who time and time again, I've found myself on the front lines of extreme weather with. And thanks to them, I mean, we've been able to do the work safely. And what I hope is effectively as well in getting the message out and opening up people's eyes to the threats that they could at some point face. Hopefully not, but potentially could.
Tell my audience about your near-death experience during the Kincade fire.
I was with Gilbert Diaz in that moment, and this was one of the first wildfires that I covered back in 2019 in Healdsburg. And I was at a hotel. I was on wildfire patrol. I was just sent up there in case a fire broke out. I was in San Francisco at the time. It was midnight when Chris Weicker, another great producer who I left out, called me up and said, get in an Uber. You've got to meet me. You've got to meet me at near my house. We're going to drive over. There's a fire. There's homes on fire. We've got to go. So I got into an Uber, went to a gas station where she was waiting for me, and she was in her old Mercedes from like the 70s. And I looked at this car and I thought to myself, okay, this fire can't be as bad as she's making it out to be, because there's no way that this car is going to be the car. And, you know, Chris has spent decades covering wildfires. We make our way to Healdsburg, and it's quiet. There are emergency vehicles around, and there was a wave of firefighters making their way up a mountain to where this fire was. So we followed. And when we arrived, it was very quiet. You could see the fire burning about a mile or two in the distance. And so we thought we were fine, and we were with fire crews. But the wind started to pick up, and suddenly you had these embers falling all around us and the fire taking root in the dry vegetation. And then you have these massive flames springboarding off and landing everywhere. And I had never seen at this point, and even beyond this point to this day, firefighters with such fear in their eyes. One of the captains there up on this mountaintop yelled, go, 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 to everybody. And the look in his eyes said it all. We might not make it out if we stayed. And so we followed this convoy back down the mountain. I was with Gilbert in his SUV, and we're on this road, and the flames were all around us, and at this point burning so thick that it was just black smoke. We couldn't see anything.
Jonathan, I'm going to stop you right there, because this is a really good place to stop, not because I want to, but because I have to. The voice of Jonathan Vigliotti, the book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. We'll finish that story on the other side of the break, I promise.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back, Jonathan Vigliotti. We're on the edge of our seats. Continue, please.
We are now making our way down this mountain road. It's myself and my photographer, Gilbert Diaz, and we're right behind a fire truck. But the smoke...
Can you see very much? What can you see?
You can't see. The smoke now is so thick. You know that the flames are on the other side of that veil, but you can't see them. It is so thick. We could only see probably a few feet out our window, to the point where we couldn't even see the emergency lights in front of us. Everything kind of just echoed light. You had no idea what was fire. You had no idea what was an emergency truck, to the point where we lost sight of the road that we were on and accidentally got off on what was a narrow dirt vineyard road. We realized our mistake nearly immediately, but it was so narrow we could not turn around, and the flames were around us. We saw them on both sides, at this point brushing up against both of our windows, hot to the touch. The smoke was coming in through the ventilation system. We were quiet. I looked at Gilbert and I was like, you're doing great. You're doing great. And we continued down this path, hoping that it would lead to a way out. And about, a minute or two, the longest minute or two of my life, we come to a dead end. There was no way out. There was no exit. And so the decision is, do you stay there and do you hope for the best? Or do you turn around and go back through what you just tried to escape, hoping that your tires won't explode, that you won't get trapped by a tree falling down, that you won't be stuck? And we decided, and this is through all the training that we have, because we do take safety very seriously, that we couldn't stay there, because even if the flames didn't reach us, all of that smoke would make it hard to breathe. And that in and of itself could be an issue. And where would we run? We couldn't run into a vineyard. We could be caught up by flames. So we turned back around. And obviously, you know, the end of the story, I'm here talking to you. We made it out. But when we got back down to safety, Gilbert will tell this story too. He teared up. I was tearing up. Our voices trembled. He has done this for 40 years. He had never experienced a moment like that in his life. We later went back a day or two later just to inspect that exit, that dirt road. And there was this massive tree that was right at the exit that was still standing when we escaped. It had fallen over during that fire some point after we escaped. Had that happened before, who knows where we would have been. And, you know, this was, again, a fire that when we responded to, we saw firefighters kind of relaxed up on the top of that mountain. It was a mile away, but it just took wind, all that dry vegetation, to create this mega fire that caught literally everyone off guard.
Jonathan, how did that harrowing experience influence what you saw and how you tried to explain what you found in Lahaina with so many vehicles scorched to cinders and clearly evidence of people trapped inside?
It's an example of Mother Nature outpacing man's ability to adapt. So first, focusing on California, wildfire has always been part of the landscape. It's good for the ecology of the environment. The fires burn dry, dead vegetation, make room for new, healthy vegetation to grow. In the 1800s, 12% of California, what is California today, was covered in slow-moving, slow-burning fires. But in the 1900s, the Forest Department came out with the first wildland firefighters, and their job was to hold back the flames, to suppress them so that communities can build safely. And it worked for nearly a century. But the problem with all of this was all this vegetation not burning every year collected and turned communities into a tinderbox to the point where we're having these mega fires. So back in the 1800s, before I get to Lahaina, you had only 10% of trees that were dying that were impacted by wildfire. Today, these fires are burning so intensely that in 2021, during the Dixie Fire, 90% of trees that were impacted by that fire died. They couldn't survive. Giant sequoias, which have an evolutionary adaptation, 2 feet thick bark, and they have tannins, this chemical that pumps through their veins that is fire resistant. We lost 10% of our giant sequoias in a 2020 fire. Fires are burning so hot because there's so much vegetation now because we've held back fires that even trees that have been around for thousands of years, some of these trees are 3,000 years old, couldn't survive this fire. In Lahaina, this is more of a modern day issue. Wildfire did not used to be as severe as it is now and has been in the past 5 to 10 years, which gave root to that investigation, that report by scientists I told you about in 2014. The most haunting scene I've probably ever covered was that line of cars that you talk about. We saw dozens upon dozens, easily more than 100 cars just in this one area on historic French Street, and they were frozen in time by fire. In this gridlock of traffic, every car was burned down to its metal frame. And we spoke with residents who put this horrific picture into perspective for me. There were no evacuation orders. And so many people had no idea that there was a fire burning until it was too late when they saw out their windows the flames. And so in this panic state, many people took to the road. The flood of traffic, that traffic jam prevented those cars from moving. The flames quickly caught up to them and surrounded their cars. And many people jumped out into the Pacific Ocean to save themselves. Unfortunately, scenes like this could be, if they are ignored, a precursor to more to come for communities that don't pay attention. And you know, if you go back to Lahaina today, everyone is now aware of the fire threat. They've just put in sensors that will trigger an alert to officials the minute a fire breaks out so they could respond accordingly. And I hope that they all work, because that scene is something that I will never get out of my head. And what makes it even more haunting, the parallels to what unfolded in Paradise, California, very similar, where you had people trying to escape and they were caught up in a traffic jam. And in so many unfortunate cases, many of the 85 people that died in the campfire were in their cars.
We have about a minute 30. This is unfair, but tell my audience who Eunice Foote is.
Eunice Foote. If you don't know Eunice Foote, that's okay. Many people don't. But now I hope her legacy lives on. She is one of the first scientists, it's debated, to have identified climate change. This is back in the mid-1800s after the first industrial revolution. And she, as an amateur scientist in her home in Seneca Falls, New York, put cylinders with different kinds of air in front of sunlight. One of those cylinders had CO2. And she learned that an atmosphere with more CO2 would lead to warming. And she put this message out in a paper, in an article in one of the science magazines, and it went nowhere. People didn't listen. As one scientist back then, a more notable scientist, said, it was ahead of its time, essentially. And then John Tyndall from England came out with a more muscled report on the very same thing, which then gave way to what we now know today as greenhouse gases. I would like to think, based on what I have read, that Eunice Foote is the first person to have identified climate change. But even if she isn't, even if it's John Tyndall, they both worked together to sound the alarms. Whether or not we listened to those warnings is up for debate today, all these years later.
The voice of Jonathan Vigliotti, the book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. It is a fantastic book. The writing is vivid, precise, and persuasive. Jonathan, congratulations. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, for your Takeout Outtake Especial. See you next week. Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial. Our guest this week, Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS correspondent, colleague of mine, author of this book, coming out just this week, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Jonathan is deeply experienced in covering the aftermath of natural disasters, be they hurricanes, wildfires, or other types of disasters. Jonathan, briefly, tell my audience about some of the things you have to do as a reporter and some of the things you've learned adaptively to do this work well and to be sensitive to those who are in the midst of probably the greatest personal trauma of their lives.
So in order to work out in the field for me, I have what I know you probably have in your possession, a go bag, which has all of the tools that I need to function on the road. My computer, my backup battery supply, a flashlight, because I do a lot of work at night for the mornings especially. Another bag that has all of my clothes and all the appropriate gear for wildfires. It's fire-resistant clothing. That allows us to get into the field and to report safely and effectively. I think when you're out in the field, and especially when you're dealing with the aftermath, because it's one thing to be reporting on the conditions that are happening live behind you, whether it's flames or wind or rain. But in the aftermath, as people are picking up the pieces, what I have learned is how important it is to listen. We go in there as journalists, but we are also people, and we are communicating with other people who have faced the worst destruction in their lives, and who are vulnerable, and who are picking up the pieces, and who oftentimes don't even know where to begin, what to do, how to cut through all the bureaucratic red tape. For me as a journalist, and what I would say to anybody else as a journalist and anybody else as a friend, I just think it's so important to listen to the stories, to tell those stories effectively, and to also know when it's time to leave and let these people process what has happened on their own. And then also to know when to return back, because I think it is so important when you leave, when you give people their space, you also don't want to forget them. And oftentimes when I've returned, I've found people desperately welcome the renewed attention after they've had that time to pause. But for me, whenever I go to any story, and especially something as sensitive as one of these disasters, listening and being that shoulder. And I know it's not a role that most journalists, including myself, feel comfortable taking on, but I think it's so important to be that shoulder for people because oftentimes you're the first person they're seeing.
Here are three threshold questions, Jonathan. Take them in whichever order you prefer. Most influential book in your life and why? All-time favorite movie? And if you're on a long flight or a long drive and going to enjoy some music, what artist or genre is that most likely to be?
The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert, which opened up my eyes to the impact climate change, if left unmitigated, could have on our societies.
A guest on this very program.
She is wonderful and amazing, and I'm fortunate that she wrote a blurb for my book. I'm grateful to her. Favorite movie? I mean, I could try to give you something that sounds incredibly smart, but instead I will tell you that my favorite movie is Titanic.
Great.
I love Titanic. And you know what? And James Cameron is fantastic, and Avatar is fantastic, and I remember where I was when I saw Titanic. I mean, it created such a moment in my life. I love Titanic. And concert
or music, just music.
Music. I love Coldplay. I gotta say, I love Coldplay. The last concert, and I don't know if this truly reflects my taste in music, but if you ask my husband, it will. I saw Taylor Swift in concert in Argentina, and she was amazing. She lived up to the reputation.
Excellent. That is Jonathan Vigliotti, our special guest. Again, the book, Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. It's been a slice. Jonathan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you next week, folks.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Jake Rosen, and Ashley Armstrong. CBSN production by Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.